Imagine walking into a doctor's office, right?
Okay.
You tell them, you know, I am just completely burnt out. I'm spiritually and physically hollowed out.
Yeah, totally exhausted.
Exactly. And their prescription, their medical advice, is to just, well, hand you a massive, heavy wooden farm tool.
Right, which sounds completely absurd when you put it like that.
It is absurd. But, I mean, that is exactly what happens in one of the most famous and supposedly most comforting passages in history.
It really is a jarring image when you actually pause and look at it. I think, you know, we have this tendency to domesticate ancient words.
Oh, for sure. We sand down the edges.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Especially with ancient texts that are meant to offer comfort, we take something that originally had these really sharp edges and a lot of grit, and we just we sand it down until it feels like a soft weighted blanket, you know,
yeah,
or a modern greeting card.
Yeah, like a spiritual bubble bath.
Yes, exactly.
So today we're taking a deep dive into a massive stack of historical research, linguistic deep dives into ancient Greek, and some theological notes surrounding Matthew chapter 11. Verses 28 through 30.
Right, the very famous passage.
Yeah, the one that begins, "Come to me, all you who are weary." And our mission for this deep dive is to basically completely shatter the modern misconception of this text for you.
Because if you read this today, it's so incredibly common to just view it as this generic comfort for modern stress.
Right, like, oh, you had a hard day at the office, here's a nice verse.
Yeah, or like a mindfulness trick for dealing with rush hour traffic. But when we dive into the first century context detailed in these sources, this invitation had a deeply subversive, radical edge to it.
It wasn't about modern burnout at all, was it?
Not even a little bit. It was a direct, pointed pivot away from a crushing, legalistic religious system.
Okay, let's unpack this, because to really understand that subversion, we have to start with the dirt in the wood.
The physical reality, yeah.
Right, we have to look at the central metaphor being used here, which is the yoke. And looking at the historical research, it's clear that for a first century audience, you know, living in an agrarian society, a yoke was not just some poetic metaphor you read about in a book.
Not at all. It was a massive physical reality of daily life. I mean, if you lived in that time, you saw yokes every single day.
They were everywhere.
Everywhere. We are talking about a heavy wooden harness. This was a thick piece of timber, often really rough hewn, carved to fit over the necks of two draft animals.
Like oxen. Right.
Usually oxen, yeah. And the whole point of this heavy piece of equipment was to hitch these massive animals together so they could drag a plow through hard-baked dirt or, you know, pull a massive cart.
So it's literally a tool of intense, grueling labor.
Exactly.
Which makes jumping from "I'm offering you comfort" to, hey, put on this heavy wooden farm equipment, a pretty wild transition for a religious teacher to make.
It sounds totally contradictory.
But the historical context notes explain that in first century Judaism, the concept of taking on the yoke was actually a really common idiom. It wasn't just about farming.
Yes, it was a very well-recognized phrase. To take the yoke of a specific rabbi meant you were submitting yourself to their specific teaching.
Their way of life.
Right, their authority, their interpretation of how the world worked. Specifically, it was often referred to as taking on the yoke of the Torah, or the law.
Okay, so you're hitching yourself to the scriptures.
Yes, to a life dedicated to following God.
Now, on paper, dedicating yourself to studying the scriptures sounds perfectly fine. I mean, it sounds like a noble pursuit.
And it was. The problem wasn't the Torah itself.
Right.
The issue, which is highlighted across all these historical sources, was what the religious leaders of the day had done to it.
The Pharisees.
Specifically, the Pharisees and the religious elite, yeah.
Yeah.
They had this practice of building a fence around the Torah.
Building a fence.
Yeah, so in their attempt to keep people from accidentally breaking a law, they added thousands of their own oral traditions, interpretations, and these incredibly strict micro-rules.
The research on these micro-rules is honestly mind-boggling. I mean, it wasn't just remember the Sabbath day. It was a complete labyrinth of regulations.
Exactly. For example, on the Sabbath, you couldn't just rest.
You had to rest correctly.
Right. There were intense debates and rules about exactly how far you could walk. A Sabbath day's journey was strictly measured. It was often limited to about 2,000 cubits.
So you literally had to count your steps.
Yes. And there were rules about what kind of knots you could tie or untie.
Wait, knots? Like shoelaces?
Literally knots. And there were intricate exhaustive protocols for hand washing. It was called Netilat Yadayim. It dictated exactly how water had to be poured over the hands to maintain ritual purity.
And if you messed it up?
If you poured the water incorrectly, you were considered unclean.
Wow. Okay. So I was thinking about this. It's like deciding you want to get in shape, right? So you sign up for a fitness class.
Okay, yeah.
But instead of just helping you work out, the instructor adds 500 impossible rules you have to memorize. And then they hand you a 100-pound backpack to wear on the treadmill.
Oh, man.
And then they just stand there yelling at you every time you step out of rhythm or, like, breathe too heavily. You aren't getting healthy. You're just getting crushed.
That is actually a remarkably accurate analogy for the religious climate of that specific time. The leaders weren't facilitating a relationship with the divine at all.
They were just gatekeeping?
Exactly. They were acting as gatekeepers with an impossibly heavy toll. They turned the pursuit of God into this terrifying, exhausting checklist of behaviors that no normal person could ever hope to perfectly fulfill.
Jesus specifically calls out this religious elite later in Matthew 23, right? How does he describe what they were doing to the people?
He is incredibly blunt about the psychological and spiritual toll. He explicitly condemns them. In Matthew 23:4, he says, "They tie up heavy, cumbersome loads and put them on other people's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to lift a finger to move them."
Man, so when you have an entire society living under that kind of constant low-grade terror of messing up a hand-washing ritual or, you know, walking too many steps, it creates a very specific psychological environment.
Oh, absolutely.
And that brings us to the actual phrasing of the invitation in verse 28. Because the people listening to this weren't just tired from a long day at the market.
No, they were completely hollowed out. And this is where the linguistic deep dive into the original Greek text reveals so much more than our standard English translations usually capture.
Right, because the invitation is, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest."
Exactly.
In English, weary and burdened just sound like synonyms. It just sounds like two different ways of saying you need a nap.
Right, like you just need a good night's sleep. But looking at the Greek analysis in our notes, it's clear Jesus is diagnosing two entirely different types of exhaustion here.
Okay, let's break that down. The first word, translated as weary, is kopichintes.
Yes, kopichintes. This implies a very active kind of exhaustion.
Active exhaustion.
Yeah, it's the exhaustion of working yourself to the bone. In the context of this legalistic society, it perfectly describes the people who are exhausted by their own futile efforts to achieve righteousness.
So these are the folks running on the religious hamster wheel.
Yes. Trying to follow every single micro rule, trying to earn their way into good standing, and just burning themselves out in the process.
It's the burnout of the overachiever who realizes the finish line just keeps moving. You try harder, you measure your steps, you wash your hands perfectly, and it's never enough.
Never enough.
So that's the active side. But the second word, translated as burdened, is pephortismenoi. And the notes point out this has a very different mechanical feel to it.
It does. Unlike the active striving of kopichintes, pephortismenoi implies a passive exhaustion.
Passive.
Yeah, it is the state of being overloaded. It's actually the exact word you would use for a beast of burden, like an ox or a donkey that has had way too much cargo strapped to its back.
Oh, wow. So it's the weight of the 100-pound backpack in the fitness class.
Precisely. It describes those who have been crushed under the sheer weight of the religious rules placed upon them by others. They aren't even running on the hamster wheel anymore.
They're just done.
They've just collapsed under the expectations. They are paralyzed by the impossibility of the system.
Wait, so he's not just talking to one type of burnt out person here. He's addressing the people who are exhausted from trying too hard to be perfect, the active ones, and the people who have just completely collapsed under the weight of society's religious expectations. The passive ones.
He sees both ends of the burnout spectrum perfectly. And what's fascinating here is how he proposes to solve it. Because if you were to take this dual diagnosis to a modern expert,
right,
like saying, "I am actively burning out and passively being crushed," you'd probably walk away with a new schedule, a medication, or, you know, a newly optimized philosophy on work-life balance.
Yeah, you'd get a 5-step plan for boundary setting and a new morning routine.
Exactly. But the solution offered here isn't a new philosophy or a streamlined checklist. It's just three words. Come to me.
Come to me.
The solution to this deep-seated societal exhaustion is a person.
Which is a massive claim.
It is a staggering claim.
I mean, if the only remedy to being spiritually and physically crushed is this one specific person that places an enormous burden of proof on him, who is he to claim he can fix this?
Right. Because historically, A rabbi's authority was based on their strictness, not their comfort.
That leads directly into how he redefines what a teacher and leader should be. In verse 29, he returns to the agrarian metaphor. He says, "Take my yoke upon you and learn from me."
Which brings up a big issue for a lot of people.
I was just going to say, I have to pause on this because it feels like a blatant contradiction.
Oh, totally.
He is looking at an audience of people who are actively and passively exhausted from carrying heavy loads. And his grand solution is, hey, I'm going to give you rest by handing you another yoke.
Right. Here's more work.
Yeah. So he's offering these exhausted people rest by handing them another yoke. That feels like giving a drowning person a different brand of life vest made of lead.
Mm.
How is this actually restful?
It's the ultimate paradox of the passage. And the original listeners would have felt that exact same friction you're feeling right now.
Okay, so I'm not crazy.
Not at all. But the answer to the paradox lies entirely in the character of the one offering the yoke. Jesus continues, "Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart."
Gentle and humble. The Greek phrase in the research is praus kai tapanos. And looking at the cultural notes, claiming to be praus kai tapanos was absolutely not how you built a following in antiquity.
Not at all. If we look at the broader picture of the ancient world, teachers, rabbis, and leaders were expected to be authoritative.
Right. You proved your importance by being severe.
Severe, distant, and rigid. You maintain control through fear and imposing impossible standards. Jesus is claiming the exact opposite here. He is saying his authority is rooted in accessibility and compassion, not in making rigid demands to prove his own superiority.
So he's acknowledging that he is a teacher, and he does have a specific way of life for his followers, a yoke. But he isn't going to stand on the sidelines and scream at them while they carry a load they can't handle.
Right. And he anchors this radical claim by saying, "And you will find rest for your souls."
Which sounds lovely.
It does. To a modern ear, that just sounds like a nice poetic flourish. But the theological sources point out that this is a direct word-for-word quote of the ancient prophet Jeremiah.
Oh, wow.
Specifically, Jeremiah chapter 6, verse 16.
So he's not just making up a nice-sounding phrase. He's dropping a massive cultural touchstone on them.
Exactly. To a first-century Jewish audience, quoting Jeremiah 6.16 was a seismic declaration. He is declaring himself to be the living fulfillment of an ancient, long-awaited prophetic promise.
A promise of rest.
Yes. He is saying that the era of striving and failing is ending, and the true, deep spiritual peace God promised is finally here.
He's telling them the wait is over. And because the teacher is gentle and humble, the actual physical nature of the tool he uses fundamentally changes. If the rabbi is different, the yoke is different.
That's the key.
Which brings us to verse 30, the climax of the metaphor. "For my yoke is easy and my burden is light."
And this is where the linguistic research really flips the script on how we read this today.
Here's where it gets really interesting. I was looking at the Greek breakdown for this specific verse, and what caught my eye is that the word easy in English usually implies sitting on the couch doing absolutely nothing.
Right. Just kicking back.
But the Greek word used here, krastos, doesn't mean effortless at all. It completely changes the visual.
It really does. Krastos does not mean requiring zero work. A much more accurate translation of krastos is well-fitting, useful, or kind.
Well-fitting. That takes us right back to the physical reality of the woodcarver's shop.
Exactly. We have to remember how a yoke was actually made. An agrarian yoke wasn't mass-produced on an assembly line.
Right. You didn't just buy a medium-sized yoke at the store.
No, it was custom carved by a craftsman to fit the specific contours of a particular ox's neck. A woodworker would measure the animal, carve the timber, smooth out the rough edges, and ensure the fit was absolutely perfect. Because if the yoke didn't fit right, it would chafe. It would cause deep sores. The animal would be in absolute agony, and it wouldn't be able to work at all.
Which means the Pharisees were basically strapping poorly made, jagged yokes onto people and then whipping them when they couldn't pull the plow.
Yes, that is exactly what was happening. So when Jesus uses the word krestos, he is saying, my teaching, my way of living fits what you were perfectly designed for. It is custom tailored to your humanity. It won't chafe your soul.
So taking Jesus's yoke isn't like taking off a heavy backpack and sitting on the couch doing nothing.
No.
It's like trading in a backpack filled with jagged rocks for a custom fitted ergonomic pack.
I love that.
You're still on the hike. You're still moving forward. There's still a mountain to climb. But the gear is actually designed for your body so you can enjoy the journey. Taking his yoke doesn't mean you stop walking. It means you stop bleeding while you walk.
That is a perfect way to visualize it. The work of living, of loving God and loving your neighbor, is still there. but the agonizing friction of trying to earn your worth is gone. And that explains the second half of the phrase, and my burden is light.
Why is it light if you're still pulling a plow?
It's light because the heavy lifting of salvation, the impossible burden of achieving total righteousness, has already been accomplished by the one sharing the yoke with you.
Man, so what does this all mean for the listener? When we zoom out and look at all these pieces together, the crushing micro-rules of the Pharisees, the active and passive exhaustion, the severe versus gentle teacher, and this well-fitting Christus yoke, we're really looking at a profound theological shift.
We are. We are looking at the definitive exegesis of grace versus law. Think about the paradigm shift our sources have laid out here. The Pharisees' yoke, the way of the law, was motivated entirely by a fear of breaking rules.
Few-based religion.
Exactly. Its nature was crushing, ill-fitting, and impossible to carry. And the ultimate result of wielding it was severe weariness and a hollow, performative religion.
Right. You're just acting the part. You're washing your hands exactly right, measuring your 2,000 cubits while slowly collapsing inside.
But Jesus's yoke, the way of grace, operates on a totally different engine. It is motivated not by fear, but by a relationship with the teacher. Its nature is Christus well-fitting and kind.
Right.
And the result is not performative burnout, but deep internal rest.
This completely rewires how we should read this passage today, because it's not a generic pat on the back for a hard day at the office. Jesus isn't promising that if you follow him, your life will suddenly be a stress-free vacation where you never have to put in effort or never face suffering.
The hike is still happening.
Right. But he is promising that the agonizing spiritual labor of trying to earn God's love, that active and passive exhaustion of trying to prove you are worthy, that work is permanently over.
The crushing weight of having to save yourself is gone. The burden of perfection has been completely lifted off your shoulders.
It changes everything about how you approach your day. If you've ever felt like you're running on a treadmill of expectations, you don't have to manufacture your own righteousness anymore. But as we wrap up our analysis of these sources, there's one more historical detail about this agrarian metaphor that changes the picture completely.
Yes, and it's a detail that brings the whole metaphor full circle. We have to remember that a yoke, historically, was almost always designed for two.
For two animals.
Right. It was a shared harness meant to couple two animals together so they could pull the weight as a team.
It's not just you in an empty space on the other side of the timber.
No. And the text clearly implies that the heavy lifting, the impossible standard of righteousness, has already been done. If a yoke is designed for two, think about who is occupying the other side of that wooden harness with you.
Wow.
You aren't just pulling a well-fitted load by yourself. You are stepping into a harness where the divine is already beside you, pulling the main weight.
So as you go about your week, really picture that. What would it change about your day-to-day, your stress, your anxieties, your feeling of burnout, if you realized you were never meant to pull the plow alone,